Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
This will be our end of the year podcast. It'll be shorter than usual. We'll do a bit of chat about the Hour record, which has had a resurgence of interest. And then we'll do a sort of little look back on the year.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Lionel, I think you've got an announcement about the Hour record. You've just confirmed this morning you're going to have a go at it as well.
No, I'm doing the two-hour record. I'm aiming for 50 kilometres in 2 hours.
When's that going to be, Lionel?
Once my extended winter break from cycling has ended, and I've worked off the Christmas weight, which will be in about March.
That'll be a great way of working off the Christmas weight. Well, we're going to have our Christmas lunch today, aren't we? We're going to join a couple of fellow scribes and have a bit of a Christmas lunch. So where are we, Lionel?
We are outside El Pirata, which is a tapas restaurant on Down Street in not far from Green Park, Mayfair, I suppose, aren't we?
Not El Pirata, is it?
Not El Pirata, no.
I have definitely heard Claudia Chiappucci erroneously referred to by certain English-speaking commentators El Pirata, which isn't correct on no score whatsoever. It's not the correct Spanish word, it's not the correct Italian word, and it's not the correct rider.
Is he not El Diablo? Was that,
yes,
that
he
right?
Was El Diablo.
Was that the same commentator that called Pantani La Diablo?
Probably, yeah. Probably.
Not really. Right, so listen, let's just do the first little bit of this short podcast talking about the Hour record. I have been today seeing Alex Dowsett, who announced that he's going to go for the Hour record on February the 27th. Also this week, Jack Bobridge and Rohan Dennis are also going for the Hour record in February before him, so it raises the stakes a little bit. He did say that was going to likely make it a little bit more difficult. That's going to be interesting, out of the three of those, all very strong time trialists. Jack Bobridge, very strange career. He's sort of stepped back a couple of levels. Alex Dowsett announcing his Hour record, which is also... He's also very motivated by the raising awareness and money for haemophiliacs. He's a haemophiliac himself. And they've got the Movistar team have got right behind it. They've talked a lot about the fact that Miguel Indurain, in a previous incarnation of Movistar, Banesto, 20 years ago set the Hour record. So there's a bit of a heritage there in that team. Who's going to have it by the end of February, Lionel, out of those three?
Oh, that's a tricky question, because Alex Dowsett's doing his on the 27th of February at the Revolution meeting. Good idea to incorporate the Hour record as part of an existing track meeting. That means the velodrome will be full, hopefully, for the Hour record, and then they'll have a track meeting after that. So it's a good way of doing it, making it into an event, rather than in the 90s, I think quite a few of the Hour records were held in velodromes that were basically empty, weren't they? It wasn't exactly a spectator friendly event, I don't think. Who's going to hold it? It's going to be difficult to say. I think it's easier to say that by the end of June, Bradley Wiggins will hold it, and all of this is kind of shadow boxing leading up to that point that we all anticipate happening.
Ooh, Dowsett won't like that. I mean, yeah, you would fancy that Bradley Wiggins will have it. What will the distance be at the end of February?
Are you ignoring me just because this is track racing, strictly speaking?
I didn't think you'd have much. You do actually have a few things. I mean, Daniel, the author of one of the definitive biographies of Eddie Merckx, you covered the Hour record quite a lot in that,
yeah.
Of course.
Oh, yeah, I'm an expert. I think... Who's the third guy? Bobridge and... Rohan Dennis. I'm not really sure about Rohan Dennis's pedigree. In long time trial, long efforts like that. Here is one of our esteemed colleagues, David Luxton, who is not going to be allowed to interrupt this podcast. Do you know what? It's something that's probably been underplayed so far because of the way the rules have changed, is the role of equipment. I mean, this it was obviously one of the key factors in the 90s. You know, there was that spate of attempts on the record because... positions were varied, bike materials were varied, the shape of the bike was varied. Now, broadly speaking, the bike should be fairly similar. However, you know, it's probably going to be 500 metres, a kilometre in it, maybe, between Bobridge and Dowsett. And, you know, some of the figures we heard quoted now about all the differences in terms of what the, you know, a skin suit can make, a bike can make, I think that will be absolutely key, certainly between those two guys. And Yeah.
Well, interestingly, I spoke to Jim McFarlane of Endura, who is the Movistar team sponsors, and they've been testing 150 materials, and they've now got 14 different skin suits, which they're testing for the event. The bike was there as well, the Canyon low-profile bike, very, very nice-looking, very understated bike, which I think the presence of the bike, the presence of the people, the press there, really made Dowsett, suddenly it dawned on him exactly what he's put himself up for.
And also, we shouldn't take for granted that all of those riders are going to complete the hour. I mean, there have been various attempts in the past which have gone badly wrong, which kind of shows as to what extent or how difficult it is as a challenge. I mean, a man who I like to think would be a friend of the podcast, Evgeny Berzin, in 1997 tried in Bordeaux, and he was a fading force at that time, but I think he only managed 17 kilometres before he got.
I'd like to see him take on Lionel for the tour record, I think. Berzin and Lionel.
Well, I need to do a bit more Christmas eating to get up to Berzin's. He's got a head start on me on that front. He's a big chap these days. Just, you mentioned about the equipment and Canyon being fully behind Dowsett's hour record attempt. The equipment manufacturers are key in sort of driving this forward, aren't they? Trek were fully behind Jens Voigt and instrumental in putting together his attempt, and Scott obviously got a lot out of Matthias Brandli's attempt. It is almost a kind of constructors drivers type effort, the equivalent to a Formula One type setup. The equipment really is incredibly important, as it was in the 90s. It's slightly different. It's not quite as space age and innovative looking. If you see the Espada bike that Miguel Indurain did the hour record on, it looks like something. Even now it looks futuristic, doesn't it, 20 years on. So the equipment side of it is interesting. But I think this kind of Bobridge, Dennis, Dowsett, it's still in the kind of the B-listers. That's not being disrespectful to any of those riders, but we are moving towards a point where Bradley Wiggins, Tony Martin perhaps, Fabian Cancellara throw their hats into the ring. And I still think there's something to be done in terms of making the hour record a televisual spectacle. It's something I suggested in our live event that we did at the Velo House in Tunbridge Wells, was if the broadcasters and the riders could get together and you could have simultaneous hour record attempts taking place in two different velodromes. Riders will choose their velodrome based on a number of factors, availability probably being the most important, but also there are technical aspects. Some riders might want longer straights or shorter straights. They might want the 250 track. Brandli set it at Aigle, didn't he, on a 200 metre track, which is obviously shorter than 250, shorter than the standard. So it'd be really good if two riders could get it together, a bit like boxers. It would be very hard to get the two people together to do it, but to have two riders going for it in different velodromes at the same time, that would make a real television type spectacle.
Well, needless to say, Dowsett's taking it very, very seriously. He's got 27 hours blocked out at the track between now and February. He's off to Mallorca to spend Christmas alone in a training camp on his own. He says that otherwise it's 2 days of colossal eating and no training. He says the quality street, especially the purple ones, he cannot resist them. So he's going to be on his own.
The green triangles.
He likes the purple ones.
Only 2 days of colossal eating, Alex. You're an amateur.
Missing out on an opportunity.
Yeah, 7 or 8 days, surely.
But yeah, I mean, there are a few, you know, for these guys as well. Somebody pointed out on Twitter the other day, nobody's ever set the world hour record in February, and one of the challenges is being in the condition to break the hour record in February, knowing that you've got a full road season ahead of you. And he did, I spoke to him afterwards, and he said that his team is obviously right behind him. They've asked him what kind of program he wants this year. The Tour de France is his big he obviously was disappointed to miss out on selection for the Tour this year, but next year they've told him they want him in the Tour de France team, where presumably he'll be supporting Nairo Quintana. But you know, he's taking it very, very seriously. I think the press conference, the presence of the media there, really hammered home to him just what a big thing he's put himself up for. Before we hear from Alex, anything else to add, Daniel, to the hour record?
No, not really. I mean, Lionel mentioned colossal eating. It's about time we got on with our colossal marathon Christmas lunch, isn't it? But yeah, after we've
we're gonna have a colossal lunch, maybe share a bottle of wine, and then come back for some more podcasting afterwards, which will be fun. But Alex Dowsett opened his press conference with a speech, really, talking about why he's going for this world hour record. He spoke very well, very eloquently about the reasons, and so we thought we'd play in full his explanation. Here he is.
Growing up with haemophilia is it's difficult. I'd say it's more difficult for my parents than for me. For my parents, it was there's no history of it in the family, so it was a real learning process for them, and quite scary as well. It is a rare condition. It's something that mum and dad had to learn about quite quickly, and it was a gloomy outlook for them. There was talk of wheelchairs, crutches, having joints replaced or fused in place because of internal bleeding problems. There wasn't really any positive way of looking at it. So we set off, and it was on a journey, I guess. And mum and dad, they cared for me extremely well. They took the doctor's advice down to the T every single time, and all the predicted outcomes are a far cry from the Alex you see in front of you today. It's, I think mum says if she'd known now, if she knew it was going to turn out like this, she would worry less and wouldn't be pestering dad for a facelift. It really was a tough time for them. And so during my off season, I travelled around Europe, and it was the Miles for Haemophilia campaign. And the idea of it was quite simple, just to spread awareness of haemophilia and to promote a healthy lifestyle. What you'd do is you'd do at least a mile of exercise, upload it to the website, and that was that. It was a very simple concept, and our aim was 6,500 miles. We actually achieved well over 15,000, so it was a big success. And what I was doing was going to these countries and just telling my story, saying how I got to where I am today. And I think I didn't realise that actually the amount of hope and inspiration that my story was given. And that was to have a mother of a haemophiliac from Portugal just come up and give you a hug just because of what you've done on a bicycle is difficult to put into words exactly the feelings that gives you. And it far, to me, outweighed winning any bike race, any fast car I might be able to buy as a result of what I can do on a push bike. This to me was much bigger than that. So then I thought, what next? What more can we do? Because it's quite clear that the better I do on a bike, the more it's inspiring the haemophilia community and the rare disease community really as well. So I think the pure cycling fans are going to hate me for saying this, but a race that starts on the outskirts of Paris and finishes in a small little town called Roubaix, the general public don't really know a whole lot about this. So whereas something like the Commonwealth Games, which in the cycling community isn't the biggest race in the world, but that hits home to the general public much more. So that's why I thought the hour record, because everyone understands a world record, and the whole concept of it, to put yourself on the line, go out there and attempt something that's going to be very difficult, I think is a message that actually goes out to the haemophilia and rare disease community quite strongly. So the hour record is something I have always looked at, something that's always interested me, and it would have always been for me, but now it kind of isn't anymore. It's I think that's what's given me a whole new sense of drive as well, is I know what it's going to do within the haemophilia community, the message it's going to send out. So I'm not really doing this for me. I'm doing this for any haemophiliac that spends their childhood being told they can't play football, they can't play rugby, they can't do anything high risk. I'm doing it for anyone with rare diseases that gets told. Basically, anyone that gets told they can't do something because of a limiting factor that is out of their control, and yet they'll go out and attempt it anyways and really try and strive to do something. And my haemophilia is the reason I'm here as a professional cyclist. I was told the same as every other haemophiliac that rugby, boxing, football were not the wisest sports. So I set out to find something I could do. And I think if I hadn't had haemophilia, I probably wouldn't have attempted to ride a bike. And it's the mentality that I have as well. And that mentality is the same in a lot of young haemophiliacs that I've met. is they're constantly being told what they can't do, and you just get sick of it, and you just end up going out there and trying to prove what you can do. So that is that's basically why we're attempting the perfect hour, and that's, you know, is a much bigger picture than whether I break or fail at getting the record. It's not, obviously I'm going to go out there, give it my absolute everything and hope that it's enough, but really if it inspires one kid to go out and do something that they thought they couldn't do, then the event will be a success, because that at the end of the day is a much bigger picture for me.
So Alex, you mentioned earlier that Chris Boardman's feet at their record were something of an inspiration, but you must have been quite a young sort of impressionable cycling fan when you watched those. I mean, how daunting is it to think you'll be trying to do the same thing?
Yeah, it's yeah, it's, the whole thing is quite daunting, and as it's got bigger, it's got more daunting. But you know, I keep going back to the reasons why I'm doing this, and that's, you know, it doesn't take the pressure off, but it just makes it that I know why I'm doing this. I'm not doing this for me. It's you know, once upon a time I would have gone for the hour record for me, but not anymore. You know, I know, I've seen in my own, seen with my own eyes that actually the help that my story gives, so that for me is far bigger. I wasn't a big Heroes guy, so it's you know, for me, I saw Boardman doing it, and you know, it was great, and it was something that I thought would be right up my street at some point. But obviously when you're that young, you don't dream of, well, I didn't dream of being at this level. I was the kind of guy who just kept chipping away and focus on the next target and then the next target. So yeah, but it's quite a position to be in.
You're probably not going to give me an answer to this one, but do you have a distance in your mind of what, you know, what might be possible?
No. I don't. It's, I think, thank you. Probably a lot will ride on how Jack and Rowan do. So, yeah, that will be, I guess that will be our basis. It's quite a difficult thing to say, because the tests we've done have been for training purposes, not necessarily to see what I'm capable of, because at this we've still got a couple of months at this moment in time. Well, in 2 months I'll be capable of a lot more than what I am now. So yeah, but I guess we will look at Rowan and Jack as references.
I mean, your team has a heritage in their record, as we mentioned earlier, Miguel Indurain, 1994. In its previous guise, when you went to the team with the idea, did you get a very enthusiastic response? Did they buy into it because of that heritage, do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I honestly don't know, but I'd have thought, you know, my movie star, I think whatever I say I want to achieve, they fully back it. I mean, I don't think there's many teams where you go to your team training camp and tell them what races you want to do this year, and they take that, they really do take that into account. So, you know, they're extremely supportive in whatever we choose. So, I'm so grateful to them and the sponsors, you know, Canyon and Endura. It's, yeah, I knew if I wanted to have a go, they'd be in full support.
I mean, do you have I guess it's the fittest you'll ever be in February. Do you have an idea at the moment of what your programme will look like beyond February?
It'll be aiming for the Tour de France again. And when we were asked what races we wanted to do, Zabio said to me he'd like me there in that Tour de France team. And so I said, I want to be there as well. And I said, and you and the team should decide exactly what you think the best approach is for it. So beyond, after the hour record, I leave my race program completely in their hands, because I trust them to give me the best race program and training program ahead of the record. ahead of the tour, sorry.
And just finally, Alex, you've been training on the London Velodrome a little bit. Is there anything about that track in particular that makes it, you know, you've ridden on other tracks, they're all a little bit different. What are the unique characteristics of the London track?
Fortunately, I don't really know enough about tracks to be able to tell you precisely. I mean, the team looked into exactly how London fares against other tracks, and it's, you know, it's quick. You know, it's the right sort of wood and stuff like that. It's I suggested London because it's a home event. I love London. It's on the Essex side of London as well. To me, that made sense. But they said to me, "Well, actually, we'd rather you did it here because this track's faster." And I'd be like, "Yeah, absolutely." So, London. London seemed like my first logical sort of place for it. And luckily everything fell into place with it.
And just Christmas then is going to be, I mean, it's always probably a pretty a time of denying yourself the usual Christmas treats, but you'll be off the mince pies completely, I guess, over Christmas.
I'll be in Mallorca on my own training. I've never done that before. I think
will
it's so
sure.
I'm going on my own. It's purely a self-motivated, self-funded training camp because I just think, you know, it's something I need to do. You lose Christmas Day, Boxing Day, you do lose 2 days training. And you do eat a colossal amount. If someone puts Quality Street in front of me, I will eat them, the purple ones mainly. And so I just thought, you know, I owe it to the sponsors, the team, to myself and to everyone that I'm doing this record for to give this 110%. And at the end of the day, in 5 years' time, if I still hold the record, or if I break it and then hold it, I'm not going to look back at that Christmas Day I missed. So.
There's going to be a few attempts in our record this year, I think. You know, Bradley Wiggins is going for it in June.
Yeah.
Any idea what kind of mark it'll be by the end of this time next year?
No idea. Haven't a clue. It's for sure Wiggins is going to be fast. Jack and Rowan are going to be fast. I hope I can be fast. It's Tony Martin and Cancellara. They've been talking about it for a couple of years. It'd be nice if one of them had a crack, I think. Million-dollar question, that. Where is it going to be?
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
We're post-lunch. Lionel's looking like a country squire, all dressed up in a tweed and hat ensemble. Looking good, Lionel. Enjoy lunch.
Lovely lunch, very nice lunch, yeah. Tapas, it's like it's selections of things from Spain.
Yeah, that's pretty much what tapas is. We've been joined by Rob Hatch. Hello, Rob.
Hello again.
And we're just going to wrap things up really quickly. This isn't going to go on for too long, don't worry. This is our kind of end-of-year show opportunity for us to say thank you very much, everybody, for listening, to give you a little hint about our plans for 2015. But we're going to go through everybody and get you to nominate a highlight for the year, really. Lionel, can we start with you? What was your highlight 2014?
I'll start at the start of the year. My highlight was probably the week at Paris-Nice. I went to Paris-Nice for the podcast, had a very enjoyable time there. It was almost like a holiday, really. It was great just to observe the racing and talk to people and try and get a flavour of that into an episode of the podcast, and just very relaxed week. The race.
I got a nice interview with Tom Boonen there about Paris-Roubaix, I remember.
Did have a very nice interview with Tom Boonen. Yeah, Tom Boonen, if you want to try and talk to him at Paris-Roubaix or the Tour of Flanders, very unlikely to get very unlikely to get anything from him. But at Paris-Nice, he was very relaxed. We had a good long chat for 10-15 minutes, and he gave his whole, sort of Paris-Roubaix life story. It was great.
And that podcast, of course, is still available for people to listen to if they want to go back and listen to our Paris-Roubaix special podcast. We did a special just before Paris-Roubaix, didn't we, where it was a general preview, but also a show about the race.
Well, all of our podcasts are available for people to listen to. You can go back on audioboom.com and search for The Cycling Podcast, or go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our whole year's output is available for people to listen to over the Christmas period. I'd point them in the direction of the Paris-Nice special, the Paris-Roubaix special, which was an excellent look at Paris-Roubaix, the Cobble Classic, the episodes from Belfast and the Giro d'Italia, our entire Tour de France oeuvre, and also my trip to the Ghent Six. They're my particular highlights.
Lionel, did you quite a lot of wine in that lunch?
Yes.
Daniel, what was your highlight of the year?
Well, it's been a trying year.
we're talking about professional stuff here. Keep it to cycling.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I think I mentioned this at our live event the other day. My almost daily interactions now with our good friend, very, very good friend, more than a friend of the podcast, I think. Almost, how would you describe Ciro Scognamiglio? He's one of our kin, isn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, my almost daily interaction with Ciro, that's been a delight. You know, the kind of Duracell bunny of the press room, just watching him in action every day at the Tour in particular. You know, as I said the other day at our live event, you will see Ciro in the unlikeliest poses, kind of tapping out his copy, kind of hanging like a fruit bat from, you know, under the desk, on top of the desk. Anything he needs to do to be able to file his copy for the La Gazzetta dello Sport and participate in the podcast at the same time. I think that was my highlight. You know, me and Ciro...
Yeah, I mean, Rob's looking slightly threatened by this, because you and Rob, of course, are housemates now, so there's a bit of a ménage à trois going on. Lionel, were you going to say something there?
Well, I was just going to say, you were talking about Ciro being the Duracell bunny of the press room, and when you said about him darting here and there like some kind of fruit bat, I don't know whether they're renowned for their energetic behaviour. But the funny thing is,
Ciro and I have this strange... This is maybe going a bit... This is giving too much away, but Ciro and I have this strange... Remember earlier in the year we talked about how I'd previously filed ex-girlfriends under the names of Tour de France King of the Mountains in my phone? Well, Ciro and I have a very strange ritual whereby we call each other by animal name every time Ciro and I speak. So in one conversation, Ciro will be the bat, another conversation it'll be the antelope, and vice versa. So you called him I liken him to a fruit bat. Or, you know, at times I do call him the pipistrello, the bat.
I was just going to say that our very good colleague from Australia, Rupert Guinness, is kind of the sloth of the press room, unknown to have a glass of rosé in the afternoon during the hot afternoon on the Tour and actually sleep under the desk.
Yeah, I've got a picture of him sleeping under the desk in the press room.
Yeah, I've not quite reached that level yet. I will have an afternoon rosé, but I've not yet fallen asleep in the press room.
Well, that brings me to my highlight of the year, was probably spilling rosé on my keyboard during the Tour de France. Not so much the incident itself, but more the fact that it was captured in all its glory on one podcast, I think St Etienne, wasn't it? Where I foolishly placed a plastic tumbler of rosé beside my computer on a very windy day in St Etienne, and it blew across my... and that was captured memorably on the podcast, which was enjoyable. And
should just say that we don't just sort of drink wantonly on the Tour, but part of the whole thing with the Tour de France press rooms, they are generally, as Daniel's often said, they're in schools or in sports arenas or in Hotel de Ville or wherever they happen to be. But the hospitality, the lunch, the buffet is put on by the local region, and often they will showcase their wines, they'll showcase the best of their food. Some are better than others. A good buffet can really make a day on the Tour, but often there'll be a glass of cold rosé or white wine, and you know, it's nice to sample the various wines as we go around France.
It's a great accompaniment with a keyboard.
Yeah.
My highlight, I've got to say, stage 5 of the Tour de France, Yorkshire. I think Yorkshire was a terrific two days. And driving a Jaguar around the Tour was pretty nice as well. We were fortunate enough to be sponsored by Jaguar. Thanks again, Jaguar, for the sponsorship during the Tour. Maybe I'll talk again in the new year, chaps. But that was fun. And yeah, the Tour was enjoyable, actually. Really enjoyed the Tour. This was the second tour. This was the first tour we went, I think, Lionel and I especially, and Daniel, with the podcast as the thing that we were there to do. And it was making history. It was great fun.
The first ever podcast to be fully accredited on Tour de France, weren't we? We're making history.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Daniel. But that was great fun. It brings us on, before I just come to Rob, to our plans for next year, because we will be back in the new year. January the 19th, we should be reconvening. Podcast should appear within a few days of that. We'll have a new sound, a new feel. We're committed for next year, and we'll have an exciting announcement, I think, for that first podcast on January the 19th. So please tune in for that. Rob, maybe you'll be a regular with us next year as well, depending on other work commitments. But
when he throws me out of the house or not.
Yeah. What was your highlight of the year this year?
Without wanting to give as a Lancashire and Yorkshire any more publicity than it deserves, yes, Tour de France was fantastic, of course, absolutely wonderful. I think we all enjoyed it. But a little bit as the forgotten moment, I think, of the cycling season this year, and it was again over here on these islands, Giro d'Italia, my favourite race. From a personal point of view, it was the first time in 3 years that I'd been back there. Absolutely loved the race.
And first time in Ireland, I think, wasn't it?
First time in Ireland as well. Bizarrely, I've been lucky enough to travel all over, never been to Ireland. Really enjoyed Belfast. Fantastic, fantastic hospitality and everything, and not just the press rooms this time. Walking down with the great Sean Kelly after the commentary back towards the pubs, and you know, we were stopped every 15 metres by people, even less, you know. Sean, what a hero, come and have a chat. And you know, he'd go and sign something, and we'd talk about cycling history and what have you, and hiding in the corner of a pub, so you know, so many people in there. It was absolutely brilliant, superb atmosphere, and Belfast certainly more so than Dublin, I have to say. Dublin was it felt a bit like the London stage of the tour. It was sort of a bit of an afterthought. Belfast, the first 2 days were absolutely wonderful, and again, just every little village on that north east coast painted pink, and you've pink balloons everywhere. It was beautiful, beautiful, lovely.
It was amazing, actually. It is almost forgotten, isn't it? And terrible weather, shocking weather, but the people of Northern Ireland especially really went to town, and it was the whole country was painted pink, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know Daniel enjoyed it particularly, but my memory is getting into a taxi, and obviously it's a city divided by sort of sectarian differences, and the taxi driver said, oh, there's no green, there's no orange this weekend, everything is pink. And I think that was, you know, major sporting events do bring communities together, and I think that was one of the finest things to see in Belfast.
Absolutely. Anything else to add, chaps, to our end of year wrap up, or are we going to go for one for the road?
Let's have another beer, shall we?
All right. Well, listen, thank you everybody for listening this year. We're very grateful to you for listening. We should say thanks to Nigel Brown, who's been helping us this year, to Paul Scoynes and John Mooney, who've been our producers, editors, and have done a cracking job.
Also thanks to Jaguar for their sponsorship during the Tour de France, much appreciated, and we'll see you all again in 2015.
We've done a few live events recently, got a few more coming up in 2015 as well, and thanks very much to people who have hosted us for live events. We're open to offers, we'll tour, we'll go anywhere, won't we, chaps? Yep. Belfast, maybe, that could be on our itinerary next year.
I mean, if we go to Belfast, definitely.
Yeah, Rob can join us in Belfast. Okay, well, thank you, Rob, for joining us, and hopefully you'll be able to join us again in the new year.
Thank you very much, it's been good fun.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, everyone.
And thank you, Daniel.
Speechless, thank you.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Okay, a special bonus feature, end of the year podcast. I'm joined by Ellis Bacon here, who, for the fifth volume of the Cycling Anthology, he's a co-editor of the Cycling Anthology with Lionel Burney, and for the fifth edition he wrote quite a long poem about the Tour de France, the 2014 Tour de France, and Ellis is going to perform the poem. I don't think read is the right word. He's going to perform the poem for us now as a special Christmas treat. Ellis, take it away.
In fair Yorkshire, where our scene begins, 'neath sunny skies, towns bathed in grins, 200 men line up their wheels, off on their way to shouts and squeals. Leeds, Harrogate, York, Sheffield, Steele, yourself against what now is real. 3 weeks ahead, 3 weeks to fear, remember well this start, Yorkshire. With royal wave, the grand départ, To Harrogate we make our start, to the brawling mauling of a flying finish, up for grabs though the British wish that one in particular who has his eye on victory, a cherished prize, can make it his, can make a play, but he is not to be the son of Harrogate today. They're clattered down by his own hand, intake of breath across the land. Amidst the crowd a mother weeps, the sun doth sink and the sun sleeps, and the day is done. Up with the sun, but the sun's undone, his path is ended here. But let the race march on, marchons, marchons, there's much on the menu. Fear, blubber houses, Greetland, moss, mid-hope stones, outer bridge, renamed Cot, and wait. Wait, wait, and go on the Jenkin road where the seed is sown. Fair Italy comes afore, a flash of blue and tricolour exchanged soon for yellow. Now the only way is Essex, my boys, and on to the capital. Through driving rain to the palace, maul, maul, and it's here that sprinter reigns once more. Return to France where the children play and the grandmère bicker and grin, and the old men listen on the wireless. Huge ears press close and they're coming. Here they come, shrieks someone, and they're right. First the swish-swish of the whirlybird blades, then the roar of the pre-show motors, then the quietude. Are they late? It's time. Are they late? It's time. Behold a torrent of silver and gold and colour and light and sound and wind. What wonderful whistling, and it all begins and it's over so fast, as they say. Yet it lingers, a French memory, once every few years. 100 years since death of men, at Menin we will remember them. And for now we will remember too how our champion fallen struggles through. Falls once too many, enough the call, a risk, he'll end it all. Enough, this time it's gone too far, dismounts, remounts the waiting car. And for the rest, those terrible stones, the sound of rattling knuckle bones, a personal sound amid the din, then boom, the sound of a well-won win. A worthy champion every day displays panache to win the stage. They lay it on the line, no guts, no glory, no long-haul plan, a short-term story. Mais le voilà, the French en tête, long overdue, lest we forget. They're 1 year shy of 30 years since badger time and joyful tears. And they come, brown-shorted cavalry, they come led first by Cadre, and provide in white the gaming French. A Pinot Blanc, what sweet revenge. Post-decades lived in tedium, de Français sur le podium. Let's thrill our friend Conquistador, whose Bastille crash ends his onslaught. His Russian, Danish, Spanish armada left rudderless, their race now harder. Without a goal, without a head, left now behind on the road he bled. And another day is done. The bunch sprint thunders, Buffalo. Torn brand of brothers, each the same goal, squeezing through gaps, unopened doors, and I've finally done it, a Viking roars. Back home I hope they'll party. What, like it's 1999? Ha, the first of the winnerless tours. Damned spot, blight of our time. The mountains, and en route to summits, in huddled groups, the watchers wait. It's here the riders creep quite slow. On melting roads, stars of the show, toil over barren, burned wasteland, accursed watchers close at hand. In coloured cloth, performing clowns, water squirted, gurns abound. This mask of pain, this face adorns, soundtracked by the diddle-iddle-iddle-iddle of comedy car horns. Ah, the Italian, yellow peril, Campione. What hope do the others have now? The podium? First loser. Slow down, Italian. Don't you know what they'll ask you? But were the others still here, they'd have gone even faster. Need us as much time as I could get, he cried. You've done that, mate. You've done that all right. Twixt Alps and Pyrenees, respite of sorts at least. Continued fight. Gladiators all bound for Nîmes. Arena finish to stage 15. Fast man from Norway, first again. Grabbed at the expense of a Kiwi win. 2 dozen metres short, pulled back. A classy try, that long attack. They lay their heads in Carcassonne. One day's repose, then they're gone. A solo feat, Australian, in the spa town, Bagnères de Luchon. O Tourmalet, O Hautacam, a win confirmed for the shark who came from Messina seeking victory and sealed the deal in the Pyrenees. Water, water everywhere, redemption flowing in. In Bergerac, a lone attack, succeeds and takes the win. The Kiwi loss in that Nîmes town, redeemed by one, Aus Litauen. Upon Paris's grand avenue, the fairer sex descend, and followed soon, on laps the same, weakened men attend. Triumphant arc, a battle won, this final search, and then it's done. The sprinter, Elise King again, the fastest finisher, the best of men, who, exhausted now, collapsed with beers, and loved ones, crying, claps and cheers. So to the winners, the bulging purse, best sprinter, best climber, third, second, first. In summertime Paris, endeth our poem, 3 weeks completed, and the crowds head home, and the day is done.